All right. Well, here's a little introduction for you. Islam, like most religions, is defined by its practice and culture. While most Muslims do not understand the nuances of the Quran's relationship with the Bible, they do live and practice the five pillars of Islam. In addition, much like evangelical Christianity, the teachings of the Quran shape the matrimonial relationship as well as women's place in society. So in this study, we will attempt to unearth the practical application of Islam so that we can better understand Islamic religion and culture. Now, so here's kind of the first question as we talk about this interaction here. Do most adherents of religion define themselves by theology or practice? What do you think? By practice, yeah. I mean, Adam, I mean, most Jews, for instance, I mean, how do they define themselves?
By the practice of the Reform or Conservative or Orthodox and then all the fragments of that.
Yeah.
There's very few theological disputes. It's just a question of application.
Yeah. I mean, one binding theological belief in Judaism, one would be you deny that Jesus Christ is the Messiah, right?
Well, that's more of a passive one than an active one. You know, they don't even bring it up.
Yeah. Yeah, and some Jews don't even believe in God, but they're still considered some Jewish because of the cultural.
My father's that way.
Yeah.
He considers himself a cultural Jew.
Yeah.
He doesn't believe that the scriptures are even, you know, he calls them old wives' tales.
Yeah.
But he wants to identify himself as Jewish.
Mm-hmm. Somebody eat kosher, somewhat observe the Sabbath. So, I mean, that would be one example. And that's the thing. I mean, we got into some of the deep doctrine of Islam, but when you talk to your typical Muslim, why they view themselves Muslim is basically because of their practices, and it's the religion that they practice. And many of them, just like many people who call themselves Christians, profess to be Christians from all denominations and all walks, they are this because of their practice. Does that make sense? So just kind of trying to bring it down to the earthy reality. Now, what type of religious adherents define themselves by theology, and which ones define themselves by practice? So who might be the, like in Christianity, who defines themselves by theology?
Catholics are by practice. They do a lot of this mass thing. Uh-huh.
But I think even within the Catholic Church, you have those who define themselves as Catholic by theology versus practice, right?
Well, that said, then you've got your Jehovah's Witnesses, your Mormons, where mm-hmm. they have a different theology.
Mm-hmm.
Evangelical Christians.
Yeah.
That's more defined by theology.
Yeah, and I guess maybe I'm kind of there. Like even within the Catholic Church, right? You have Catholics who define themselves because, well, I go to the Catholic Church, I take the Mass, do the Eucharist. And then you have others who, well, I believe in transubstantiation, I believe in the Holy Roman Catholic Church, and that the Pope is the overseer. What separates between one who defines himself theologically and one who defines himself, let's say, even culturally or by practice? Any thoughts, Rick?
I'm not following you yet, Dave.
Okay, maybe I'm just off. Well, I guess the greater point that I'm trying to make is probably the more devout and knowledgeable would define themselves by theology. They're able to make a direct correspondence between what they believe and what they do. Okay? And I would like to think that our church is that way, right? I mean, we really put a high emphasis on what you get out of the Bible and what you believe impacts what you do. But the reality is that most people who, let's say, call themselves Christian, I mean, why? What would they say? I'm a Christian because what? I was raised that way? Yeah.
97% of the people live and die in the same religion their parents were.
Yeah.
97%.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever that religion, Hindu, yeah. Buddhist,
whatever. Okay, so I was raised that way. What else would they say? I'm a Christian because okay, and that would be the theological Christian, right? So that's a theological answer. I go to church, yeah. I believe in God in a very loose way, like everybody else. I go to church. So you can see how there's some people who define themselves culturally and other people define themselves by theology. We're a church that's trained to define ourselves theologically. So when you look at what is it, 1.3 billion Muslims in the world, I mean, realistically, how many of them do you think really define themselves theologically? Very few. I mean, look at all the Christians, the billion Christians or so in the world. How many of them define themselves theologically? I mean, very few. And so that's why it's good to kind of take a step back and look at just the practice of Islam, because this is what causes them to consider themselves Muslims, okay? So that was a bad question to try to flesh that out, so my apologies. So in light of all this, I mean, why is it important that we understand the practice of Islam?
So we can at least tell them why they're doing what they're doing. Why are you doing this act of practice?
Yeah. And that's a good question to ask them, to just to make them think.
And then they will step them up and say, well, I don't know why, just my dad and my granddad did.
Okay.
And that's why I think we can understand it more.
Okay. It's helpful. Yeah, why else? Why is it helpful to just kind of, in light of this, to just understand the practice?
Yeah, I don't think if you understand their practices that you could witness to them about Christ effectively, because you wouldn't be able to make any correlation between your faith in Jesus and what they're doing.
Yeah, and you kind of bring, again, the gospel is sufficient for anything, but sometimes when you are confronting, let's say, a Jehovah's Witness, there's certain fields of combat that have to be engaged, like the divinity of Jesus Christ, right? And we talked about that with some of the theology. But I think this is just good to understand just how they see things. And when you just understand their practice, some of the things that they value, that's kind of true of all Muslims, it kind of helps you to engage them a little bit better. So what we're going to do is you look at a Muslim, they basically define themselves by the five pillars of Islam. The first pillar is confessing the faith. And keep in mind, a Muslim remains a Muslim if they sincerely repent of their sins and will make it to paradise or Jannah. And you have the five pillars. We'll go over each one. The last one, the pilgrimage, is not required, but an attempt usually is, but we'll get into that. The first one is the confession of faith. The Shahada, the most condensed summary of Islamic belief in two short statements. One bearing witness that there is one God, the other bearing witness that Muhammad is God's messenger. These statements provided adequate marks of identity for the early Muslim community. The confession of one God separated the monotheistic Arabs, Muslims, from other Muslims who are generally polytheistic. The reference to Muhammad separated Muslim monotheists from other monotheists, such as Jews and Christians. Repeating the confession once, sincerely and preferably in the company of witnesses, makes one a Muslim. So we might have baptism, right? That's how you publicly identify yourself as a Christian. They would say the Shahada. And you don't have to say it in front of people, but it's certainly recommended. Okay? So that's the primary pillar of Islam. To be a Muslim, you have to make that declaration. The second one is the prayer. Ritual prayer is the most distinctive visible mark of the Muslim. Five times a day, Muslims follow carefully prescribed patterns of physical movements, prostration, bowing, and standing, while reciting prescribed prayers. Each cycle of movements is called a rak'ah, and each prayer time consists of 2 to 5 cycles. Prayer is performed in the direction of Mecca, the sacred center, and the one praying is expected to have prepared a sacred state and a sacred space from which to conduct those prayers. And so they'll have their carpet that they throw down. And these prayers usually take about 5 minutes. The big one is the afternoon prayer during lunchtime. That's where they might actually gather in a mosque or a prayer center. Prayer can be made anywhere, though the Friday noon prayer routinely is done communally at the mosque, place of prostration. In Muslim countries, often all other activity comes to a halt at prayer time, and the most memorable sound for visitors to Muslim countries is likely to be the call to prayer, often boomed out over loudspeakers from a minaret or tower of the mosque. At dawn, noon, mid-afternoon, dusk, and late evening. So it's something you do five times a day, every day. You do five-minute prayers with a longer one on Fridays during lunch. Was that, Bill?
One other thing you need to do before any of this is a ritualistic washing of your feet.
Mm-hmm. And that's probably the preparing the sacred space. And
you're supposed to.
You're supposed to, okay? Any questions about that? You've pressing that, huh?
How do they do that, though? Anywhere they're at, they stop and pray, right?
Mm-hmm.
During their prayer time. So how would they wash their feet in the middle of the afternoon?
You know what? It's interesting. In the Minneapolis airport, they actually wanted to put special sinks so that they can wash their feet. Be prepared. Go ahead, Adam.
There's been a lot of lawsuits recently where they're forcing public places to install these foot baths. Airports, universities, places of work. I think there were some conflicts with the Somalis that were here in Tyson, where they wanted to stop working in the middle of the day. Everybody all at once trying to shut the line down.
And didn't Tyson agree with it?
Well, they're not here anymore, so apparently it's became too much of a problem.
Yeah, I don't know.
I think they agreed, but then they created problems.
Well, I think that, weren't they boycotted in town? I thought there was quite a conflict for a little while.
Yeah, I wasn't really up to speed on that.
I believe the sacred Catholic Church got a grant from the federal government for $150,000 to establish Emporia as a refugee site for Muslims.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they were brought before the city council. He said, well, you get the authority to turn Emporia into this.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was quite a bit of conflict.
Yeah, and you see that Islam, in many ways, is not culturally transferable. It doesn't meld into other cultures, like Christianity to a certain extent does.
They don't want it to be. There's a policy called Dawah, which is how they move into other places. Move in, set a beachhead up, bring people in, have lots of kids, and then force other people to to accommodate.
Yeah. And in fairness, in the West we have a weekend, right? Saturday for the Jews and Sundays for the Christians, which are set aside as times of worship, not so much now anymore. We now is meant for the worship of recreation. But we did structure our society around some of those things. So it's, they want to do the same thing. But that's kind of one of the ritual things is to pray five times a day. Now here's another one is fasting. Yeah.
Uh-huh. These prayers that they do five times a day, are they pretty much prescribed to them what they're supposed to say?
I believe so. Mm-hmm. So it's ritual prayers. So it's,
same thing every time or different?
I don't know. Do you know, Bill?
They're pretty similar.
Yeah, I don't know if there's
like
too much.
Rosary.
Yeah, that's probably a good equivalent. I'm sure you have different ones that you can use maybe to mix it up a little bit, but it's like the rosary, the prescribed liturgical prayer.
There is a sermon, though. You say the prayers. And
yeah. Yeah. And that's on Friday, right? Yeah. So that's kind of their Sabbath. Well, let's look at fasting, Psalm. Muslims are expected to fast during the month of Ramadan. Ramadan is regarded as auspicious, very favorable time of blessing, being the month in which Muhammad received the first Quranic revelation. The fast is strict, no food, drink, or sensual pleasures during the daylight hours, marked off by whether there is adequate light to distinguish between black thread and white thread. Children, the aged and the ill, pregnant women, and travelers are exempt, although one is expected to perform a delayed fast later, when one is able. During the month, a heavier emphasis is placed on pious reflection, attendance at special mosque events, and the reading of the Quran. The fast ends with the great feast of fast breaking. And this is pretty interesting because the Islamic calendar, the month of Ramadan actually moves throughout the year. You can't just link it to one month. And so let's say you are a Muslim in Kazakhstan, in the northern parts of Kazakhstan, and it happens, Ramadan falls in June. I mean, that is pretty onerous because you might have 1 or 3 hours of genuine darkness there. And so it can be pretty oppressive during that time. But the fast is just no water, no eating. You guys know who Akeem Olajuwon is? He was the famous center for the Houston Rockets, and he was a practicing Muslim. I mean, he'd play playoff games and would refuse to drink anything during the games.
They're wonderful parties when the sun goes down.
I'm sure they are.
The best parties you've ever been to.
Yep.
They really are.
Yeah, once the sun goes down, I mean, you can eat all you want, but while the sun is up, you have to observe that. And so next you have the giving of alms, zakat. Muhammad's first observations about life in Mecca reflected his concern about iniquity. Whether this concern was rooted in his own experience as an orphan is unclear. What is clear is that he often challenged the social ills, and his message first attracted this disadvantage of Mecca. In Mecca, Muhammad attempted to address such iniquities by imposing a tax on all believers. The tax was set at a varying rate on specific goods. And in the initial years of Islam, the tax sufficed to meet the various needs of the community, from poor relief to building of mosques. In addition, voluntary charity was encouraged. Unlike Christianity, which encouraged asceticism and voluntary poverty, Islam restricted charitable giving to a maximum of 1/3 of one's possessions. Normal family life in society was to be maintained, the monastic impulse largely checked. In the modern world, few Muslim countries have an official zakat tax. It is more often voluntary contribution to support the poor, pilgrims, debtors, and volunteers in jihad, as well as the collectors themselves. Yeah, so it's kind of interesting how they actually put a check on giving. So you can only give up to a third, you're supposed to keep the other 2/3. So it kind of explains how being a wealthy sheikh is not necessarily looked down upon. Pilgrimage to Mecca, the Hajj. To Muslims, Mecca is the sacred center. It is the home of Adam and Eve, of Abraham, of his son Ishmael, and of Muhammad, the final prophet. As a sacred center, not only is it the destination for Muslim pilgrimage, it is a forbidden city to all non-Muslims, as is Medina. The pilgrimage in the last month of the Muslim calendar involves a 6-day regimen that each pilgrim must follow while in the area of Mecca. Many of the features go back to Arab religious practice prior to Muhammad, but the activities have taken on a specifically Islamic meaning. Mecca is still the center of the pilgrimage, the black stone is still the sacred object, and the Kaaba is the sacred house around which the pilgrims still circle, as in pre-Islamic times. But each activity is now associated with events in the lives of Abraham and Ishmael. From Hagar's frantic search for water to save her son Ishmael to the stoning of Satan. For most of Muslim history, a pilgrimage to Mecca involved great cost, time, and danger. Some individuals spent years on the pilgrimage and thousands died on the way. Considerable respect was paid to the one who had completed the pilgrimage, and the pilgrims were permitted to affix the title of Haji to their name. From the mid-1900s to the present, modern, fast, and relatively inexpensive means of transportation have caused the number of pilgrims to swell from about 30,000 to over 2 million. This has put considerable pressure on the pilgrimage sites. And so you hear about stampedes, something burning down. I mean, it's when that was put in there, it wasn't meant to service 2 million people. So, no, yeah. No, they have there's a cave. I think there's a cave where he had his revelations, right? And I think
there's a Medina, you go cast a stone at the pillar.
Yeah.
And then you go to a couple of.
Yeah. So there's a couple of sites out there. I think there's another. I think there's a famous well there.
So do you just go to one site, or do you go?
You go to them all. You make the circuit. Uh-huh.
Well,
it's interesting. It's this it's that you can find it. You can Google it and find a picture of it. It's a black rock in the middle of the square building in the middle of the major mosque. And they kind of pulse around it and you go in and you touch it. It's supposed to be a sign of blessing. Yeah, and I'm not quite sure what the black rock has to do with their theology.
Black rock was the religious scam that their parents ran.
Yeah, that's what it was. They co-opted it into their religion
that Muhammad's parents ran that fell off in popularity.
But I don't know what theological import they attribute to it now.
They
do you know?
It was a sign from God.
Yeah.
Some think it's a meteor. It came down. It was a sign.
Yeah.
Oh.
So yeah, it's. And again, I mean, if you just talk to, yeah, why is it important to see that black rock? Well, it's holy, it's special. We're commanded to do it, but I don't know how that syncs with the rest of Islam. I tried to find out one time and didn't get a satisfactory answer.
So it's almost how to worship.
Yeah, more or less, yeah.
Parents' religion also used the crescent moon, which mm-hmm. is now symbolic of Islam.
Yeah.
This Muslim calendar, you say they do it at the very end of the Muslim calendar, is that December?
No, the Muslim calendar is moving. They don't have 365 days in their calendar.
Just
whenever it happens to fall.
It's a lunar calendar, not a solar calendar. Similar to the Jewish calendar, the calendar is quite the same.
So it moves throughout the year. It's not going to be on the same year that we have by our reckoning. Now, what do all these duties suggest about the means of salvation in Islam?
Regimented.
Yeah. Now, honestly, how difficult would it be to keep all these commands? Yeah.
But wouldn't it be fairly simple after a while because it would just become a daily
routine? Yeah, okay, you look at the first part, making the confession.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can do that. The praying five times a day, that might be a little bit difficult, but if you lived in an Islamic country where that's just what you did, it wouldn't be too terrible. You look at the fasting. I mean, 1 month, everybody does it. You look at the giving 2.5% of your income or whatever. I mean, you could do that. One-time pilgrimage to Mecca. I mean, it's difficult, but it's not an impossible bar, is it?
Yeah.
Does that make sense? I mean, as long as you're disciplined and you just do it every day, you can be a complete practicing Muslim. And there's other things that they have, like dietary regulations and everything, too. But if you live in a strongly Muslim area, it's not impossible to hold to all these things. Now, how does that contrast with the biblical thresholds that are offered?
For Christianity.
Yeah, for Christianity, yeah.
Well, so you have to be more like, I mean, you have to make yourself like Christ, and it's very hard to become perfect. It's impossible.
It's impossible to become perfect, right? The standard is perfection.
Yes. So it'd be extremely difficult.
Yes. Impossible. It is. It's impossible. Once you've done one imperfect action, it's impossible to become perfect. So you kind of see how this really contributes to the works-based religion of seeking to really earn and merit your way into Jannah, into paradise. Yeah.
On the Iranian side, Adeline had to remind me the name of it. It's Maharam. And that's when the Shiites literally beat their backs to the point they're bloody. And they take knives to their children's head.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Pillar of
oh, they add that one? Yeah, these are the five traditional pillars that I have. Yeah.
Is
that a Shiite thing?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, and keep in mind, there's three major schools, the Sufis, the Sunnis, and the Shiites. Now, here's kind of an interesting thing when you look at Islam and women. Okay, Sharia law basically gives women only half the value of men in terms of testimony and compensation. Thus, two female witnesses equal one male witness in an Islamic law court, where verdicts are arrived at primarily by counting the name of witnesses on each side. The same injury sustained by a man and by a woman will result in compensation for the woman at 50% of what the man receives. Similarly, a daughter generally inherits only half of what her brother does, and this is justified by the greater responsibilities of men. So I'm going to read you a surah. This is 434, okay? Yusuf Ali. Men are the protectors and maintainers of women because Allah has given the one more strength than the other and because they support them for their means. Therefore, the righteous women are devoutly obedient and guard in the husband's absence what Allah would have them guard. As to those women, unto those women on whose part ye fear disloyalty and ill conduct, admonish them first. Next, refuse to share their beds. And last, beat them lightly. If they return to obedience, seek not against them means of annoyance, for Allah is Most High, great above you all. Pickthal. Men are in charge of women, because Allah hath made the one of them to excel the other, and because they spend of their property for the support of women. So good women are obedient, guarding in secret that which Allah hath guarded. As for those from whom ye fear rebellion, admonish them and banish them to their beds apart, and scourge them. Then, if they obey you, seek not a way against them. Lo, Allah is ever high, exalted, great. Shakir. Men are the maintainers of women because Allah has made some of them to excel others and because they spend of their property. The good women, therefore, are obedient, guarding what is unseen. Allah has guarded. These are actually three different translations, okay, of the Quranic text. Guarded. And as to those on whose part you fear desertion, admonish them and leave them alone in their sleeping places, beat them. Then, if they obey you, do not seek a way against them. Surely Allah is great. Okay, so you see three different translations of the Quran of the same passage. Now, what infraction of the woman merits threefold discipline process? Yeah, desertion.
You say suspicion.
Yeah, it says if you fear their disloyalty, if you fear their rebellion, but it doesn't say they actually have to rebel, just if you think they're going to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you have desertion. You fear desertion. Another one is you fear rebellion. And then the other one is disloyalty and ill conduct. Okay? Now, does a woman necessarily have to actually rebel for her husband to take action? Why or why not? Mm-hmm.
And then he can take whatever action to correct her before that.
Yeah, exactly. It's preemptive, okay? Now, what three steps does the Quran instruct men to take? Okay, so you look at the first one. What do they have? The threefold process is?
Admonish,
followed by?
Leave them alone.
Yep, and then? Okay. Now, it was interesting. How do they translate beat them lightly in the other two versions?
Beat them,
yeah.
Modifier of
okay. Yeah.
This is hard to believe, but there's on the internet there's Mary TV. It's TV from the Middle East.
Uh huh.
The producers of it are brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
There's Jews from New York do all the production work.
Mm-hmm.
Simply the TV programs of the Middle East.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then they put it on Mary TV, and then they put the captions below it.
Yeah.
And it gives you how to properly beat your wife.
Okay.
They actually demonstrate it?
Yeah. It's probably the proper methods.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you need to consult a mullah for the proper method to beat your wife.
Yeah. So we'll talk a little bit more about that. But what was the second punishment?
Refuse their beds.
Refuse their beds. Now, why would that be devastating? Yeah, giving birth to who?
Sons.
Yeah. And it's really interesting, the most cherished relationship for a Muslim woman would be the relationship she can have with her son. Yeah, that is the pinnacle of the relationship. That is what they want. They want to bear a son and be close to their son, because the son will love them in a way their husband never will. Yeah. Yeah.
The mother actually does it.
Mm-hmm.
And brings the child into Islam.
Yeah, so there's a real special relationship. And so to be deprived of that, I mean, is to lose your meaning as a woman. Okay, so it's a very, which is interesting, fear desertion, which she wouldn't be in the same bed with him anyway. But that's part of the prescriptions that they have. Now, some other apologists claim, some Muslim apologists will claim that beating refers to a symbolic act such as striking with a feather. Does this passage suggest this?
No.
Yeah, especially when you look at the other translations, okay? Now, other apologists claim that women can stop this process at any point in time by seeking a divorce. How does this defend this passage against some of the obvious criticism?
Gives
a woman out, yeah. She doesn't have to take it. If she doesn't like this, no one's making her stay. All right? But 7, the children of a Muslim marriage belong to the husband and his family, whether the wife is divorced or widowed. She must hand over the children, though she can keep the babies until she is done nursing. In light of this, what choice does a wife really have? Can she divorce her husband and stave off a beating?
Probably not.
No. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it puts in a very, very vulnerable position. And she loses her children. I mean, what mother would walk away from that? Okay? So you see, I mean, this is a real oppressive religion. Now, consider the following Essay-Quranical quotes. Do these suggest the Quran does not allow for spousal abuse? Those of you who are afraid of their disobedience, which symptoms become evident to you, threaten them with the fear of God and banish them to their beds and scourge them. In case of a husband's ill treatment of his spouse, the Quran permits reconciliation of spouses and arbitration, but in this case, the wife, it allows her scourging. Umar ibn al-Khattab came to Muhammad saying, "Women have dared to disobey husbands." He allowed their husbands to scourge them. Many women approached Muhammad complaining against their husbands because Muhammad received a verse for the Quran which commands their husbands to scourge them. On the authority of Muhammad, peace and blessing of Allah be upon him, he said, "Hang up your scourge in a place where your wife or wives can see it." Okay, so I mean, it's read the Quran, it clearly sanctions beating your wife. Now, in contrast, how does the Bible esteem women?
As a gift, as a power.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Be gentle
with her. Yeah, be gentle. Who are the first witnesses of the resurrection?
Women.
Women. Now, that's one of the reasons. There's many reasons, but that's one of the reasons why the Bible, it just rings true. Because in that day and age, I mean, you look at in Islam, women only had half the value as witnesses. But who was it who saw the women, who saw the empty tomb? It was the women. And that is just what it is, even though that would be slightly embarrassing at that time. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and it might have been because, well, part of it is just the nature of it. But you see that there is a value of women. It talks about in Christ there is neither male nor female. All of us have the same standard. They're made in the image of God. I mean, when you look at the Bible and especially the New Testament teaching relative to where the culture was at that time, I mean, it was really progressive. And that's why when people say that the Bible is patriarchal, well, it is by today's standards where they've taken egalitarian places where the Bible never intended it to go. But it is very much a religion that honors women and calls for them to be protected and to be cherished. That it commands husbands to not beat their wives, but to die for their wives and to love their wives as Christ loved the church. So an interesting contrast. Now here's a note. The fact that one of the major translations adds lightly to the command to beat your wife, as well as the abundance of Muslim apologists who tone down this decree, demonstrates that there is a moderating influence in Islam. So there are some Muslims who do try to moderate this command. But I think any fundamentalist Muslim who reads the Quran like we read the Bible would have to come to that conclusion. Yeah.
There's also a huge difference between what they tell each other and what they tell us.
Yeah.
They're commanded to lie. It's,
And there might be some, but I mean, I think, to be fair, there probably really are some Muslim men who do treat their wives well and would apply the feather thing. Not that they would literally do that, but they do try to moderate and try to tone it down. So there is a moderating influence in Islam, and I hope it grows and spreads. I think we all do. But now it seems like the radical part seems to be surging. But a lot of Muslims in Europe, for instance, and especially a lot of the academic circles and stuff, are relative moderates who symbolically keep all these things, so not as strict. Now, 10, what care and caution should we take with engaging Muslims on this issue?
They're going to turn it around on you.
How so?
I think this is hard to say, that they're going to turn it around by saying, who are you to talk? Your society has 50% divorce and 70% born out of wedlock in some racial groups.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They're going to turn it right around on you.
Mm-hmm. And there's a reason why there's a lot less divorce in Muslim cult. And there's a lot less, I'm sure there's a lot less adultery too. But for certain reasons, right?
We're going to get defensive is what I'm saying.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's the thing. I mean, if we're going to witness to them, is this really the issue we want to come after?
That's right.
Okay. But what I think what this does, and the reason why I brought this up, is it gives you, I think it gives you an understanding for a lot of the Muslim women and the misery that they're in. I read an interesting book, The Bookseller of Kabul, and is a Norwegian journalist integrates into a Muslim family just to write about it. And because she was an outsider, she had access to the men. Because she was a woman, she had access to the women. And those women just live a sad, lonely, miserable life. And it's interesting how a lot of women are not allowed to marry the person they really love. They're forced into these family marriages to marry somebody who's good for the family, somebody who has money. And so you might have a 16-year-old married to a 52-year-old man. And what 16-year-old wants that, right? And there is adultery that happens because they still have these strong, passionate feelings for this forbidden love. And it does take place. It does happen. And some are executed and beaten and all that stuff. So it's a real oppressive culture for women. And that kind of brings to just some principles of witnessing to Muslims. Number one, avoid unnecessary criticism of Muhammad. Such harsh words will only infuriate those who habitually refer to their prophet with honorific terms. When discussing Muhammad, refer to him as your prophet Muhammad or the founder of Islam. Christians can use these terms with absolute integrity while not giving offense to the Muslim. Does that make sense? So don't call him the prophet Muhammad because he's not a prophet. You can say it's your prophet, he's the founder of Islam, they'll be fine with that. So just be sensitive. Don't want to create any ire that doesn't need to be there. Two, bring the questioner to consider Christ instead of counter the claims of Muhammad. And so focusing on what Jesus says. Remember, as we talked about last week, there is a reference that they have for Jesus. They consider him to be one of their prophets. Okay, so Scripture and the Bible does have a voice with Muslims. See, understand that there are varying degrees of Islam, from the westernized Muslim who keeps Ramadan in a half-hearted way to the extremists who would like to see the formation of Islamic State. So everyone is different. If you accuse the westernized Muslim of being radical, you're going to lose a lot of credibility real quickly. It would be like somebody accusing us of being just like Fred Phelps, right? Who wants that? D, remember that as a white Christian, they see you as a hypocrite as they view all whites as Christians, including actors, musicians, right? Britney Spears claims to be a Baptist. Thus, let them know that you are just as shocked and appalled as they are about the sensuality, greed, etc. of the West. E, beware of cross-gender witnessing. Men and women are to avoid eye contact with each other, even in the midst of conversation. In addition, women should wear loose-fitting clothes. F, use your knowledge of Islam to grease the wheels of a spiritual conversation. I mean, it'd be really interesting to just say, yeah, we heard about the five pillars of Islam. And just ask them some questions. Get them thinking. I mean, get them from just being a cultural Muslim to actually think about some of the theology of why do you do that? What do you hope to achieve? And then you can really inject some teachings about what Jesus teaches. Do you know that your prophet Jesus said these things? Right? Because he is one of their prophets. G, be prepared to answer the three major Muslims' objections that Christians, one, worship three gods, see the Son of God as a physical description of Jesus, and the Bible has been corrupted. And so how do you explain the Trinity? That is one God in three persons. Take them to the passages, take them to the Bible, explain it. Two, explain that Jesus wasn't necessarily a created being, but that he's the Son of God. That's a title that's been given to him. That's his identity. And the Bible has been corrupted. We talked about how manuscript evidence clearly shows that it doesn't. Okay, but those are the three reasons why they reject it. H, direct them to the New Testament and challenge them to consider the claims of Christ. While a spiritual debate on the merits of Islam may open their eyes to their own religion, a discussion of the Bible will pierce their hearts. So take them to the scriptures. Remind them that this is considered to be a holy book. Ask them if they've read it. Point them in that direction. I build a relationship with them. A friendship with a Muslim will give you a chance to unravel the stereotypes which Muslims have of Christians. J, if you invite Muslims into your home, realize that many of them adhere to food restrictions. So confer with them before you make their plan. Don't give them cheeseburgers with bacon or anything, right? Just be cautious. Yeah. So just ask them. We'd like to come over. Now, what are you allowed to eat and what aren't you allowed to eat? So we can be sensitive to that. Yeah, just respect them, right? And K, understand that conversion will come at a great cost. The convert will likely lose their friends, family, etc. Thus, the church must be especially eager to embrace a converted Muslim into their spiritual family. Okay? Any questions about that? And I think a lot of this, I mean, just be a curious person. Just want to learn about them. Try to understand where they're coming from. You can take this class or you could just ask them, so what do you believe about Allah? What do you believe about Jesus? What do you believe about your prophet Muhammad? Who was he? And just engage them.
I have done that.
Mm-hmm.
Working for the government for so many years, I traveled a lot to Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
And there were times when I would go out in the evening just to a coffee shop and sit down. And sometimes I would encounter Muslims who would actually approach me and start talking to me. And actually, initially I didn't realize it, but they were teasing me.
Mm-hmm.
And when I would ask them about their religion, they would just refer to me as this infidel, knows nothing, and so on. I was kind of the butt of all their jokes.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't happen just once. It happened practically every time I met them. It was just like,
I mean, I had a conversation with some Muslims in college, and I actually found them to be very warm, engaging, kind people. You know, one thing about Islam is a real high virtue on hospitality. They will prepare a feast for you. I think that's just part of the Arabic culture that they inherited. So, a lot of them can be antagonistic, and I think there probably is a growing antagonism now than there was beforehand.
Not understanding their religion, maybe I offended them right from the very beginning.
Yeah, and just say, yeah, I'm familiar. Yeah, so you practice the five pillars of Islam. Now, are you guys Sunni or Shiite Muslims? Or are you Sufi? And they would be like, oh, you know the difference, right? And so just having some familiarity can really open the doors. I've noticed that when I bring up with Catholics. Oh, so do you practice the Mass? And I ask them, they think I'm a Catholic. And I was like, no, I just have some interest in the religion. And it can open up doors. Same thing with Muslims. So that's why just showing some familiarity with it could open up more doors than you realize. But you know what? Some people are just jerks. And there's Christians who are jerks, and there's Muslims who are jerks. So, okay. Any other questions? Well, conclusion. Islam transcends mere teachings from the Quran. For the Muslim, Islam is a way of life. It impacts your family, friends, employment, social interaction, worldview, etc. Thus, it is with great cost that a Muslim leaves their faith. Fortunately for the Muslim, God can overcome any obstacle which Satan throws in his way. The same God who created the world in 6 days, parted the Red Sea, and raised the sun from the dead can transform the hearts of Muslims and set their feet on the path of life. May we have the courage and conviction to boldly proclaim the liberating truth of the gospel to our Muslim friends and neighbors. All right, well, let's pray. Father, I do thank you for this time to just study this religion, and I pray that you will help us to have compassionate and kind and engaging conversations with Muslims, that you might bring some into our lives, into our path, and that we might share the hope of Jesus Christ with them. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.